From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. It is exactly 1 week until Election Day, and more than 66 million people have already voted. That number, nearly half the total votes cast in the 2016 election. Today, President Trump and Joe Biden are trying to reach Americans in several key states who haven't voted yet. And just last night, the U.S. Supreme Court denied an effort by Wisconsin Democrats and voting rights groups to extend mail-in voting. The court ruled 5-3 to uphold November 3rd as the final day ballots could be received. So anything that comes in after Election Day won't count. NPR election political national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now for the latest. And Mara, Wisconsin Democrats say this Supreme Court decision could disenfranchise thousands of voters. The U.S. Postal Service is now recommending that people in Wisconsin mail their ballots today to get them into the hands of election officials on time. What's at stake with this ruling?
What's at stake is potentially hundreds of thousands of ballots, not just in Wisconsin, but there's similar cases in North Carolina and Pennsylvania that are going to come before the court pretty soon. This is about ballots that are postmarked on or before Election Day, but received afterwards. Now, many more people this year are using mail-in ballots because of the pandemic, and the post office has been very slow to deliver mail. Some Democrats even charge that the post office is slow walking the mail to slow down the receipts of mail-in ballots. But what Democrats were particularly astounded by in this real ruling was the wording of Brett Kavanaugh's concurring opinion, where he seemed to echo Trump's Twitter posts trying to delegitimize the election. He said that we want to avoid the chaos and suspicion of impropriety that can ensue if thousands of absentee ballots flow in after Election Day and potentially flip the results of the election. I mean, and Justice Kagan wrote back saying there are no results to flip until all the valid votes are counted. Votes are always counted after Election Day. But Trump is tweeting again today that any results, any ballots that come in after election night or are counted after election night should be considered legitimate. So sounds like when Amy Coney Barrett comes onto the court, they're going to have a 6-3 majority to rule the way Trump wants.
Well, just last week, Chief Justice Roberts sided with liberals to uphold a Pennsylvania court ruling that ballots could be received up until the Friday after the election. And now we have this case in Wisconsin. So what do we know? Tell me some more about the context surrounding this Wisconsin case.
Well, he didn't. All he did last week, the Pennsylvania court case is coming back before the court. And when it comes back, Amy Coney Barrett will be on the court and there will be a 6-3 conservative majority. And Chief Justice Roberts will no longer be the swing vote. It won't matter if he sides with the liberals because there'll be, you know, five conservatives. But all he did last week was keep the decision open. They decided not to take up the Pennsylvania case. So they let the Pennsylvania state court ruling stand, but now they're going to get another crack at it.
Yeah, it was a 4-4 vote. Speaking of the campaign, the president
was 4-4, right?
Yeah, yeah. The president has a very busy schedule today. Rallies in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nebraska. Nebraska may come as a surprise. Why is the president going to this traditionally red state?
He's going to Nebraska because Nebraska gives its electoral votes by congressional district. It's not a winner-take-all state. It's winner-take-all by CD. And there are two congressional districts in Nebraska, and one of them, where Omaha is, has a lot of Democrats. So he's playing defense here. Nebraska is the kind of state that a Republican should never have to campaign in. They should be able to take it for granted. But it's possible that one of those electoral votes could go to Democrats, and he doesn't want that to happen.
Well, meanwhile, Joe Biden's in Georgia. Polls show that race in a dead heat. A Democrat hasn't won a presidential race in Georgia since the early 1990s. So what are the travel schedules of both of these men? Tell us about the state of the race.
Well, it tells you that Joe Biden is playing offense. The fact that he's in Georgia, Democrats feel that after the top tier swing states, Georgia might be the most gettable state for them. It also has two Senate races, which is really important. If Joe Biden is going to win, he wants a majority of Democrats in the Senate. So they're hopeful about Georgia. He's tied with Trump in the polls. And it shows you how the map is expanding. And at least based on the travel schedule of the candidates, it looks like it's expanding in the Democrats' favor.
And just briefly, what do you expect with a week now to go?
I think you're going to hear the closing arguments from both candidates. A lot of it will be about COVID. COVID is surging in a lot of swing states, but the message from the president is COVID's in the rearview mirror. We're rounding the corner. Joe Biden is a career politician. He's been around for 47 years and hasn't done anything. Joe Biden, of course, is saying that Donald Trump is the wrong person to lead us in the pandemic, and that he presents himself as the antidote to Trump's divisiveness and chaos.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
You're welcome.
This final week before Election Day, we're watching a number of close governor's races across the country. In Missouri, Republican Governor Mike Parson is facing a challenge from Democratic State Auditor Nicole Galloway, who would be the first female governor of Missouri if elected. Jason Rosenbaum is a political correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio. And Jason, what's happening in this race in the final week, and what do polls say?
Well, the two candidates are incumbent Governor Mike Parson, who became governor after Eric Greitens resigned. He was previously the lieutenant governor. The Democratic candidate is Nicole Galloway, who is the only Democratic statewide official in Missouri and the only female statewide official in Missouri. Polls, public polls have showed Parson ahead and actually running ahead of Trump in this state, which is unusual because traditionally Republicans don't do as well when the race is between like 0 and 10 points. And most polls show that Trump is on track to win by 6 or 7. So we'll have to see if that bears out, because the conventional wisdom is if it's a closer race than 2016, when Trump won by almost 19, it's not as good for the Republican, in this case Parson, than it could be.
I know that Parson has come under fire regarding his handling of the coronavirus. He even tested positive for the coronavirus himself. What can you tell us a bit about what his actions have been in stemming the number of cases there, and what's been public reaction about that?
Unlike a lot of surrounding states like Illinois, Parson has given authority to localities, mainly counties and bigger cities, to decide restrictions such as mask mandates or occupancy limits. And that has caused a lot of controversy, especially in this race, because someone like Galloway has argued that doing a county-by-county approach doesn't provide as strong an effort as doing something that's uniform across the state. I have personally actually driven around rural Missouri mainly for mental relaxation, have seen very few people wearing masks because there's no mask mandate in a lot of these rural places. So that has garnered a lot of criticism, but Parson has said that the state is different depending on where you go. It doesn't necessarily make sense to have a one-size-fits-all policy. And enforcing a mask mandate has been challenging even in states like Illinois, which have stringent regulations. So I would say the reception has been mixed, but obviously, as I think has been alluded to, COVID cases in Missouri have been pretty high, and I think it's become a big issue in this race.
Nicole Galloway she's now the only Democrat in statewide office in Missouri. She's also now the only woman who's running for governor. What can you tell us a bit about her?
Nicole Galloway was appointed auditor in 2015 after the death of Republican auditor Tom Schweik. She also has experience as Boone County's treasurer. And I think that she is trying to use her experience as auditor, pointing to the amount of waste and fraud she's uncovered, as kind of a selling point for her candidacy. She's also 38, so she's a millennial. She would be the first millennial governor, and she would be the first female governor if elected. One of her challenges, though, is even though Democrats have made a lot of gains in places like St. Louis County, there's not a lot of evidence that they've won back areas that they've lost over the years in rural and exurban Missouri. So for her to win, she has to do better than just win a lot in St. Louis and Kansas City. She has to broaden her geographical coalition.
Current Governor Parson is an ally of the president in a state that went for President Trump by almost 20 percentage points in 2016. How do you think presidential politics are factoring into this governor's race?
Well, as I mentioned before, typically Missouri statewide elections are heavily connected to the presidential race. And I think that Republicans won up and down the ballot in 16 because it's really, really hard for a Democrat to win when the presidential candidate is losing by 19 points. I think everybody I've talked to in Missouri says Trump is not going to win by 18 or 19 points. It's anywhere from like 3 to 9%. And as I said before, the typical tradition in Missouri is the closer the presidential race is, the better it is for Democrats. So Parson is confident that he'll be able to actually outrun Trump, but it'll remain to be seen. Like the early voting numbers in places like St. Louis County have been huge, and that would be a better sign for Galloway than it is for Parson.
Jason Rosenbaum is political correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been nearly 100 years since the now infamous Tulsa massacre, where as many as 300 black Tulsa residents were killed by mobs, police, and National Guardsmen after a black man was accused of attacking a white woman there. Now, an archaeological dig at the Oak Lawn Cemetery in Tulsa has unearthed a dozen victims' coffins. It's part of an effort to locate the remains of the victims who were quickly buried without funerals, death certificates, or official records. Brenda Alford heads the Citizens Oversight Committee for the project. Her grandparents were survivors of the massacre, and she joins us now from Tulsa. Brenda, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So before we get to this archaeological dig, tell us a little bit about your grandparents. What were their names and what happened to them on May 31st and June 1st of 1921?
My grandparents' names were James and Bessonor Nail Sr., and along with my great-uncle Henry Nails, they were the owners of the Nails Brothers Shoe Shop and Record Shop that was located at 121 North Greenwood Avenue in various locations throughout the community. They were also the owners of the Lacey Park, wherein the Nails Dance Pavilion and Skating Rink was located. On that fateful day, my grandparents, along with their then 2-year-old daughter, family members and friends, ran for their lives, only to return to find our homes and our businesses looted and burned to the ground.
This massacre is a legacy you've carried with you your whole life, and now there's a push for more information. So let's talk a little bit about this project. It's relying on cemetery records from 1921 and information discovered by Oklahoma's Truth Commission in the late 1990s. Tell us more about the goal.
Well, the goal is to find the victims of the race massacre, to give them the due respect that they deserve.
How long will this dig continue?
As long as it takes. The process is a very tedious one. I've had the honor of being there each and every day of the excavation process down in the trenches.
Were you there when they found these coffins believed to be the victims?
Yes, I was.
What was that like?
I tell you, time stood still for me for a moment, and I was just overcome with emotion, if you will, because I was thinking of those victims that were lost so tragically, and I'm thinking of my grandparents, who lost friends and neighbors along the way as they were running for their lives from Greenwood Avenue. And it was just a moment that was just very, very filled with so many different emotions, if you will.
Yeah, I can imagine there's also so much that you feel about the people who are no longer here. To be able to be a part of this, to be able to actually put the names with these people and mourn and grieve them in a way that they should have been mourned and grieved back then.
Yes. Along with my family members, as a little girl, I knew, many of the older generation at that time, and they had suffered through this tragedy. And I think about it now. I think about the community that I grew up in that was so loving, so kind, and they gave us their best in spite of what they had endured. And I feel like I am standing in their stead in this moment in time, this historic moment in time. And if anything, I hope they know, amongst any and everything else, that their living was not in vain.
What will be the process to find out the identities of the victims who were found?
Our archaeological team, along with the city of Tulsa, will determine next steps that will be taken in order to gain access to those victims, to also go through the process of hopefully identifying as many as we can.
You also said that this hard work is helping to, quote, find the truth. Can you explain more about what you mean?
For many, many years, various members of the community shared that there were victims at Oak Lawn Cemetery and other locations throughout the city. And we just want to delve into that history and to bring that truth to light. My reality every day of my life is that if my grandparents and our family members had not survived those terrible days, I would not be talking to you.
Tulsa's mayor says the excavation is a matter of conscience and reconciliation, that he wants to do right by the victims of the event. At this point, what would that mean, doing right by the victims, and what would you ultimately like to see happen?
I would like to see the opportunity for us to give them the proper burial that they deserved. If there are family members who are still alive, to give them that opportunity to bury those members in a humane way, to have a situation where we can always have a memorial, give them the opportunity to put flowers on their family members' graves, to remember them always.
Are they digging today or this week?
No, we're not digging right now. We're at a standstill right now to determine what our next steps will be. We want to finish excavating to see if there are any more coffins in that area, and then we need to get the permissions that we need to basically exhume those bodies and the caskets. So that will be a little bit of a process. But it's something that I am very grateful, as I said, and humbled to be able to do in this day and time, because I do this in memory of my grandparents, my family members, and my community members, because they deserve this and so much more.
We've been talking to Brenda Alford. She's the head of the Citizens Oversight Committee for the archaeological project that seeks to find the bodies of victims killed in the 1921 Tulsa massacre. Her grandparents survived that massacre. Brenda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Well, in New York State, more than 400,000 voters have cast ballots since in-person voting began on Saturday. This is the first time the state has had early voting during a presidential election, and voters have been turning out in record numbers. Julia Ritchie of North Country Public Radio went to a busy polling site in rural New York to talk with voters.
It's a little before 9 a.m. on Saturday morning when I arrive at the Board of Elections office in Canton, New York, near the Canadian border. Already there's a line forming on the first and second floors of the building with people eager to cast their ballots.
Okay, I'm ready for one more, but can you come here?
Upstairs is Jenny Bacon, the Democratic Election Commissioner for St. Lawrence County. She's standing by the entrance to the room where people are voting and waving people in one at a time.
We're trying to keep everybody socially distanced as much as possible. We can sign in three people at one time. We have four privacy booths and two machines. So we're moving people through as quickly as possible.
Bacon, who's wearing a silver necklace with the word vote on it, says she expected good turnout, but even she was surprised to see a line this early.
When I got here, I saw a ton of cars in the parking lot, and I thought, oh my gosh, there must be something else going on. I'm thrilled with the turnout. I work all year long to have people come and vote.
As a man walks up with a filled-out ballot, she instructs him on how to insert it in the machine.
Slide your ballot into either machine, any way. No, it can face either way, up or down.
He soon walks out, and Bacon peels off an I voted sticker.
Here, you want a sticker, sir?
What the heck?
Most of the voters I spoke to in line said they felt more comfortable voting in person than by mail. They cited news reports over the summer of controversial changes by President Trump's Postmaster General that resulted in mail delays across the country. I also met several first-time voters, like Harry and Lori Simpson. They're both in their 60s and say they don't really follow politics.
Are you excited to cast your first ballot for president?
No.
No?
Nope. Like I said, I don't follow politics at all.
But that changed this year with what she describes as President Trump's mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic. She works at a local hospital and has seen people coming in and out with the virus. It was her husband, Harry, though, who convinced her to actually come vote. They're both voting for Joe Biden. Harry says Trump downplaying the severity of the virus changed his mind about voting.
I just find that he's not a really good leader.
And for anybody to think that it's going away, it's not. It's not going away.
Especially when you see someone that works in the hospital that can see everybody coming in and out of there. So,
yeah. Trump thinks it's just going to disappear, and it's on a down. Yeah. But it's not. It's rising big time.
Most of the dozen or so voters I spoke to on Saturday said they were voting for Biden, and many mentioned the coronavirus as a top issue. But there were a few conservatives who also took advantage of the early voting period as well. Outside the Board of Elections, I ran into Gary Gilbert and his sons, Ben and Thomas. Gary and Thomas wore Trump 2020 hats, while Ben wore a Trump T-shirt along with shorts and flip-flops. Ben said he hadn't expected to wait in line outside in the cold.
Can I ask who you're voting for?
Donald Trump.
So tell me a little bit about why you want to vote for President Trump.
Because I'm conservative. I like his policies. I don't like his rhetoric, but I do like his policies.
Ben, who's 19, also chimes in.
I'd say the biggest issues for me are abortion and immigration, probably.
Gary said he was planning on voting on Election Day, but his son, Ben, was excited to cast his first ballot in a presidential election and wanted to go early. Ben says he's aware that Trump likely won't win New York's 29 electoral votes, but feels he's contributing to the popular vote as well as to down-ballot races. According to the St. Lawrence County Board of Elections, about 460 people cast their votes on Saturday. Another 400 voted on Sunday. This is only the second year the state has had early voting as an option, and New Yorkers will have another full week until this Sunday to vote in person before Election Day. For Here and Now, I'm Julia Ritchie in Canton, New York.
Facebook could be the next Silicon Valley giant to face an antitrust lawsuit after that landmark report from the House Judiciary Committee earlier this month that likened the tech companies to oil barons and railroad tycoons. State attorneys generals and the Federal Trade Commission have now reportedly met to discuss possible legal action against Facebook as soon as November. For more, we're joined by Casey Newton. He's the editor of the new newsletter Platformer. And Casey, how likely is a case against Facebook, and what would the legal basis for it be?
Well, we know that they have been investigating Facebook for over a year now. The FTC began looking into Facebook's history of acquisitions last June. They've been really interested in what has happened in the social media world since Facebook acquired Instagram and WhatsApp. And there is a lot of thinking that those acquisitions have made it extremely hard for new entrants to come into the market. So it seems like if an antitrust case is filed next month, that those acquisitions are going to be at the heart of it.
Well, we were just talking about the Department of Justice filing a civil antitrust suit against Google last week, accusing it of anti-competitive and exclusionary practices and labeling it the monopoly gatekeeper of the internet. Would this potential action against Facebook be similar?
You know, of course, we'll have to see, you know, what winds up being filed against Facebook. But if it's what we think, it should actually be rather different than what we saw the government do in the Google case. The Google case is about how Google will strike these search deals so that if you have an iPhone, your default searches will all be through Google. Google makes a lot of deals like that. Facebook doesn't do anything like that, right? But, you know, I think what you're seeing more broadly is the government is finally reckoning with the enormous power that tech giants like Google and Facebook have, and they're trying to understand the various ways that that power is anti-competitive. So I think that's kind of the through line.
I see. Okay. Has Facebook responded at all to these latest hints of an antitrust case?
Facebook has responded by talking about how competitive their market is. Every time I talk to somebody from Facebook these days, it's, well, you know, Casey, we're up against TikTok, and you know, everywhere we turn, there's another challenger looming on the horizon. So Facebook is making a very loud case that it is threatened on all sides, and you know, that the government's case, should it emerge, does not hold water.
We're, of course, 1 week from Election Day. Do you think the outcome of the presidential election could actually have a big impact on the trajectory of these ongoing antitrust investigations?
You know, I've heard mixed things on that front. Some people will say absolutely not. There are a lot of career civil servants working at the FTC and the Justice Department, and they'll be prepared to carry this case through no matter who is the president. It's also true that both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have been really critical of these companies, and both have called for reforms, although, you know, pretty different ones. So, you know, I do imagine on some level that the kinds of regulations that would get passed in the next 4 years, if any, would be very different depending on who the president is. But I think that regardless of who wins, we will see a lot of scrutiny on these tech giants.
That's Casey Newton, editor of the newsletter Platformer. Casey, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Wisconsin has some of the highest coronavirus infection rates in the country, and COVID hospitalizations are now at a record high. Dr. Rachel Hughes is on the front lines. She's an emergency physician at SSM St. Mary's Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. Dr. Hughes, thank you so much for being here. I know it's a very busy time.
Thank you, Peter. I'm glad to be joining you.
And Wisconsin is in the middle of a COVID storm right now. How busy are you?
We are definitely seeing more and more coronavirus patients in the emergency department. Overall, our numbers in the hospital have actually dropped over the weekend, but our coronavirus numbers have significantly increased.
Well, and have you noticed any trends about who you're seeing and how sick they are?
The thing that I see in the emergency department is that this is a disease that hits all parts of the population. Every one of the 2,000 people who have died in Wisconsin, or the 200,000 people who have died in the country, are someone's friend, mother, grandparent. And remembering that and remembering that each of my patients is a person is what gets me to work every day.
Well, certainly. I'm very glad that you point that out. And we have been speaking with families whose loved ones have died because of the disease. And you're right. It's more than a number. It is a person. So when you are treating those people in the hospital, you know, what is going through your mind? How urgent is the crisis?
We are feeling challenged and exhausted, but we are professionals and we want to get everyone through the pandemic as much as they want to get through it. Patients are scared. They're afraid sometimes when they get a diagnosis of coronavirus. Sometimes they're angry. You know, they didn't realize that they could get sick or what it was about their interactions with other people that caused them to catch the illness. And I share with every patient that I see the science-based information that's important for the community to have about social distancing, washing your hands. This is information that we've been sharing since the beginning of the pandemic, and I totally understand when people feel like they want new information, they want new treatments. But the truth of the matter is that those simple, well-established public health measures are actually the best thing that the community can do to help us as we deal with more and more coronavirus patients.
I spoke with a doctor in Utah yesterday who's facing a similar surge, and she said her nursing staff is depleted. Scheduling people to work is a major problem. Do you share those concerns?
So an increase in cases in any community puts a strain on the healthcare system. And here in Madison, we've seen coronavirus hospitalizations more than double in recent weeks. And, you know, when staff get sick, we cannot instantly manufacture more healthcare workers with years of experience and training. It is time for everyone to take the pandemic seriously. And the best thing they can do is follow the public health guidelines. These things really work, and we're asking for the help of the community as we, you know, care for their family members in the hospital.
Okay. And how are you coping with all this? We often hear about the mental health struggles and the stress that frontline workers are going through. How are you holding up, and what are you doing to keep yourself feeling okay through all this?
although when I work in the emergency department, I'm often the only physician, emergency medicine is really a team sport. And I work with like an outstanding group of nurses and techs and pre-hospital providers. And that means a lot in terms of supporting my wellness. I also have great family support. But that being said, I mean, the pandemic is definitely challenging. And the donning and doffing of protective equipment and the important screening procedures, every interaction with every patient is more difficult. And I got into this because I enjoy talking to patients and hearing their stories. But with COVID, that important part of my job is not always possible. You know, with our protective equipment, we can't even always hear one another very well. And that has led to some creative solutions. But, you know, it's a very different job than I had a year ago.
I bet. Dr. Rachel Hughes, an emergency physician at SSM, St. Mary's Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin, experiencing a surge of coronavirus cases there. Dr. Hughes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wisconsin is also a key swing state in the upcoming election. Until President Trump narrowly won Wisconsin in 2016, it had been blue for decades. Trump is campaigning there today. It's his third visit in 10 days as he tries to hold on to the state. Joe Biden plans to visit on Friday. Joining us now for a closer look at Wisconsin is Catherine Kramer. She's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Kathy, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
And it was a surprise to many people when the blue wall of Wisconsin and other states in the Midwest fell in 2016 to Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton famously didn't even campaign in Wisconsin that year. What did we learn about the state of Wisconsin 4 years ago that you're taking into 2020?
I think we learned, or maybe we were reminded, that Wisconsin is actually a pretty purple state. It had gone for a Democratic presidential candidate since Ronald Reagan in 1984, but the closeness of the race here made people realize it's not a guaranteed blue state, and people are definitely taking that into 2020.
We know one of the keys to President Trump's support in 2016 was the white blue-collar worker. How does it look this year?
Well, it looks like he's still doing relatively well with white men, but his support among white women is not necessarily so strong, and in those smaller communities around the state, you do still see some strong support for President Trump, but there's also considerable support for Joe Biden this time around.
In what areas does Joe Biden have the advantage?
Well, he definitely has the advantage in the metropolitan areas, primarily Madison and Milwaukee. And a lot of the rural counties are pretty purple, and some of those counties that went for President Obama in 2008 and 2012 and then switched to Donald Trump in 2016, it looks like many of them are going to switch back to the Democratic candidate Biden this time around.
Well, there are two other factors we didn't see in 2016. Number one, the coronavirus pandemic, which is raging in Wisconsin. And of course, the police shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, of Jacob Blake, which sort of epitomizes some of the conversations we've been having about race in this country. Yeah. What role will those issues play in this election?
I think they're both playing a big role. Racism is front and center in Wisconsin here in a way that it hasn't been perhaps ever. And the police shooting in Kenosha was just such a major event. It just brought things very much to the top of the mind for many people. And the pandemic, you know, we are experiencing a major surge in this state. And so it's brought the pandemic front and center, and also just the partisan divide over the pandemic is front and center for us right now.
Can we talk about the suburbs for a moment? I remember in 2016, I made a trip to Wisconsin and I was doing some reporting in Waukesha. Everybody was talking about, you know, this part of Wisconsin that I believe is just outside of Milwaukee and how key it was to the election for both candidates. What about the suburbs this year?
I mean, the suburbs, the Milwaukee suburbs in particular, are really key to President Trump. If he's going to win the state, he has to do really well in those places. But the issues that you've raised, both pandemic and racism, are complicated issues in the suburbs. And for, on the one hand, let's just take race in particular. I know a lot has been made about the suburban white woman, and I think that is a really key demographic, especially when it comes to race, because we do see a pretty significant gender divide on whether people think President Trump is better for race relations. We just had a poll come out from the University of Wisconsin, our Elections Research Center, showing that 55% of women in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania think that Joe Biden is better for race relations, and only 34% of women in those three key states think that Donald Trump is. And that plays out in the suburbs as well. So it remains to be seen exactly what's going to happen in our suburbs, but they're a really key part of the state to watch.
And we know it's dangerous to read the tea leaves too early in a state like Wisconsin, because right. In 2016, all signs pointed to Hillary Clinton winning, but it was ultimately the state that helped tip the election into President Trump's favor. Do you expect something similar to happen this year?
I think that we won't have a surprise here in Wisconsin. I mean, the polls have been pretty stable and trending towards Joe Biden consistently in the last few weeks or month and a half. But as you say, you can't read the tea leaves too early. It really is going to take until all the votes are counted to know for sure.
Kathy Kramer, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Since the pandemic began, we've been hearing from families who have struggled with the abrupt switch to online learning. Some have adapted, but the reality is many kids don't have computers or internet access. David Freudberg of the Humankind Public Radio program looks at the digital homework gap and how libraries are helping to close it.
The shift to remote K-12 learning has been disruptive to families, to students, and to educators. And that's for those who have digital access. According to Pew Research Center data, about a third of low-income households with school-age children lack high-speed internet access at home. Some of these kids have mobile phones, but not computers. And that presents a problem, says Hallie Rich. She's the communications director at the Cuyahoga County Public Library outside Cleveland.
There are tasks that students have to complete. Think about yourself if you had to sit down and write a 5-page essay on the scarlet letter, having to type that out on a cell phone versus being able to sit down with a keyboard, either connected to a laptop or connected to a desktop.
When the pandemic hit earlier this year and students were required to learn remotely, Sharon Tawney faced a challenge. Her low-income household in Cleveland, with two sons in high school, had no computer.
At first, I was figuring out how are they going to finish their schooling for this year. I was having them go to the library, but then the library's closed down, so it's like, okay. And all I had at that time was a little 8-inch tablet that did not connect to their school.
Although all 27 Cuyahoga library buildings shuttered in April for safety reasons over several months, Hallie Rich says the library system was very aware of high demand by library patrons.
So we kept the Wi-Fi on while our buildings were closed, and the signal extended out into the outdoor areas, the parking lots surrounding our branches. And from the day that our doors closed, we had people in their cars sitting in the library parking lots to access our Wi-Fi, which became essential.
Even before the pandemic, libraries throughout the country had seen patrons clustering around the building during off hours to access the internet. But for Sharon Tawney's children, trying to do schoolwork that way was impractical. A friend loaned them a desktop computer. Her younger son David is now in 12th grade at Lake Erie International High School, a public charter school. Last spring, when schools closed, David, who has autism, says the adjustment to distance learning was difficult.
I'm an early bird when it comes to school. I get up and do school in the mornings and stuff, so it was kind of hard for me because I just want to get my schooling done, but then I let my brother get on first so he could get his schooling done, so I had to change my routine, what I've been doing.
A couple of months ago, as high school was gearing up for the new academic year, parents were notified that a nonprofit called PCs for People would make refurbished computers available free to families with demonstrated need, supported by local charities. So Sharon Tawney went to her local Cuyahoga library, where a pickup of the equipment was arranged.
It was two computers with a couple extra power cords in case. The only thing I had to get was a webcam. Everything else was included, the keyboards, the mouse, the Wi-Fi capability to connect to the wireless internet.
Tawney was grateful to get the computers, and now online learning and interacting remotely with teachers is routine with her boys. And she says it's made a big difference at home.
It stopped the fighting, and it actually is a lot better for them to talk to their teachers to get the help they need, and me not trying to go crazy trying to figure out how to help them.
Her son David agrees.
It was kind of relief because I could talk to a teacher while my brother's talking to a teacher. And it was also a relief because it could help me move on faster without someone else needs a computer to do their stuff.
David says he's been able to make progress on his studies this year in English, algebra, and environmental science. Hallie Rich with the Cuyahoga County Public Library says students and families can schedule free online appointments where library staff offer training in how to navigate remote learning platforms like Zoom.
It's initially about getting people the physical equipment that they need to connect. They need that computer or that laptop. They need that internet connection. But even once they have both of those things at their disposal, it's the digital literacy that they need in order to make use of those materials.
And as a core service, the Cuyahoga Library, like many public libraries around the country, continues to help people develop basic skills required in the internet age. And that includes not just students, but also patrons who are newly unemployed in the coronavirus recession and who need help applying for jobs online. For Here and Now, I'm David Freudberg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
As long lines for early voting pop up around the country, Americans with disabilities are facing unique challenges. We check in with a disability rights advocate. That's next time on Here and Now.